for this afternoon, 96-2184, State v. Jerry W. Sample. Mr. Sample is represented by Gary Sealing. Mr. Sealing, are you ready to proceed?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Gary Sealing appears on behalf of the appellant, Jerry W. Sample. May it please the court. This afternoon we are here with regards to one issue, and one issue only, and that issue being, is there such a thing as a one-person conspiracy? The question before the court this afternoon is to determine the intent of our legislature in adopting our current statute 939.31. Both appellant and respondent agree that Mr. Sample, the appellant, was convicted of a unilateral conspiracy, there being two viewpoints on inchoate conspiracy. The first being bilateral position, and that says that at least two persons must intend that a crime be committed. The other viewpoint is the unilateral position. Under the unilateral position, it is not required that two or more persons intend that a crime be committed. It is only required that one person intend that a crime be committed. Appellant's position is that Wisconsin's law is bilateral because that is the intent demonstrated by our legislative reference services, by case law, by public necessity, and by the uniqueness of conspiracy as a group activity. The appellant, Mr. Sample, does not seek or urge a change in the law. In our position, we are seeking only the application of existing law. First, if I may address legislative intent. It is our position that existing law states that two persons must have an agreement that intends the realization of a criminal objective. In 1953, the legislature reformed Wisconsin's conspiracy law, abolishing common law conspiracy and adopting our current 939.31. The comments of the 1950 and 1953 legislative councils make no indication that the legislature intended to adopt a unilateral construction. There is no mention of it anywhere in their commentary. And I would also note for the court that there does not appear to be any significant changes between the commentary in the 1950 and 1953 versions of the legislative council. In fact, a reading of the legislative council's commentary indicates that the legislature intended that conspiracy is a group crime. Briefly, in its commentary, the legislative council stated that the scope of the crime of conspiracy is best understood by analyzing its elements.
How do you respond to this question with regard to legislative history, that when first enacted, the statute was really borrowed from the Louisiana statute? The Louisiana statute expressly was bilateral, and that language was deleted when we borrowed it.
Well, I agree that the Louisiana language was bilateral, and I am aware that Wisconsin did borrow from that. In the commentary that the Legislative Council put out in both 50 and 53, they referenced the Louisiana statute, but most prominently and first in order, they referenced the Arizona statute, which I referenced in my reply brief. And Arizona's statute at the time also required a bilateral construction as well as Louisiana's. And it was not until 1978 when the Arizona legislature specifically adopted a unilateral construction statute that Arizona converted to a unilateral construction.
Mr. Sealing, am I correct that we wouldn't get to the legislative history if we felt that the statute was plain on its face, that the meaning was plain on the face of the statute?
I don't believe so, because I don't believe the question that we bring before the court this afternoon has been addressed by this court. It has been addressed in various cases by the Court of Appeals. This court did deal with it, although not in so much of a direct challenge, in the case of State versus Smith, which was a recent court case, which I believe this court decided that two persons are needed for a conspiracy.
Now, this particular issue is really an issue of first impression in Wisconsin, is it not?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So that the cases, you can sort of pick and choose language in cases to support either the unilateral or the bilateral approach, can you not?
Under Wisconsin law, to the best of my knowledge, there has never been a case that has supported the unilateral viewpoint as Wisconsin law. I'm not aware of any. Specifically, I refer the court to the two court of appeals decisions of Copening, I'm not sure if that's the correct pronunciation, and Blalock. Both court of appeals decisions and inchoate cases, which both stated that two persons are required for a conspiracy. Now, there have also been a number of party to a crime conspiracy cases, as well as civil conspiracy cases, which have additionally stated that you need at least two persons.
Well, we do have two persons here. That really isn't the issue. Isn't it not whether or not one of those two persons can feign intent?
Intent, that's correct. It's whether or not two persons need to intend the realization of a criminal objective. And that, I believe, the case law is, in Wisconsin, is very uniform in the fact that two persons do need to intend a criminal objective. This is a conspiracy is a group activity. It is not a solo activity.
Your version would rule out any police agents going in and helping the defendant to commit the crime, because the agent, the police agent, would never have the intent to actually commit the crime. Is that right?
Yes and no. Yes, that it would not be prosecutable as a conspiracy. However, it still could be prosecutable as another crime, a different crime. Well, we're arguing, yes, when the police agents come in and feign participation, act as decoys, and you have no other participants, then yes, it's not prosecutable as a conspiracy.
Let me ask you about that, because just in terms of common sense, it doesn't seem to make any sense to me, because if what we're focusing on is a defendant's mindset, his intent, his or her actions, whether or not the other person, in this case the police agent, is also intending to commit the crime, the defendant on whom we're focusing thinks that person is intending, and he or she is conspiring with that person ultimately to commit some felony or commit some criminal offense. And the mindset of the specific defendant is the same whether the other person is actually intending to want to commit the felony, or as a police agent trying to set the person up. And don't we just simply focus on the defendant's state of mind as opposed to what anybody else may be thinking? I mean, it may be a common sense argument, but it seems to me that there shouldn't be any line drawn between what the second person is thinking, as long as the actual defendant is combining with a second person with the intent to commit a crime.
I would disagree with that, because conspiracy is a unique crime in that it is a group activity.
But each defendant, you have to assess each co-conspirator's mindset and actions in deciding whether or not his or her intent is to combine with the others to commit a crime. Right? I mean, that's how you decide whether somebody is guilty of that crime, is by assessing his or her actions and state of mind to combine with others in order to go forward with a felony or a crime.
Through their objective behavior, yes. In the case presently before the court, this was a plan that a sheriff had set up through a confidential informant. He brought in an undercover police officer.
All things your client didn't know. Your client thought that he was conspiring with somebody else who was a co-conspirator. I mean, for purposes of this record of discussion.
To be honest, I'm not sure exactly what his state of mind was.
Well, we can assume for purposes of the discussion that we're having here, can we not, that as far as he was concerned, he was co-conspiring with another individual, and your argument is that he can't be guilty of a conspiracy because the other person, in fact, was a police agent and therefore did not intend that the crime be committed.
He could, however, be guilty of other crimes.
In this case, lesser crimes.
Anyway. Not necessarily a lesser crime. It could be a crime of equal severity.
So the person, your client's guilt or liability for a conspiracy is not based on anything he thinks or knows or believes or acts, but in fact on the state of mind of what we hear is the police agent.
It is based upon what actually transpired among all the participants, the co-conspirators, as...
Well, it's not what transpired, it's the state of mind of the non the non-conspirator, the police agent? Because your argument is his state of mind, the police agent's state of mind, is not to commit a felony. He's working with the police, and he has no intention of committing the crime of distribution of cocaine. So your argument is, for the bilateral analysis, you look at the state of mind of the non-charged defendant in this case. I mean, it seems to me that you know, it doesn't seem to make any sense to me, and I understand that there are cases and there's law that recognizes that, but that doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, if you look at the totality of what your client was doing vis-a-vis another person and what he believed the situation to be, he in fact is doing the same thing whether the other individual intends that the felony be committed or not.
I think that analysis can best be understood, as I said earlier, that recognizing the conspiracy is a different sort of crime. It is a unique crime in that it is a group activity.
So you have to have the other person's state of mind as well as yours.
You have to have a group. And well, therefore, yes, you would look at whether or not you have co-conspirators or not.
If I understand your argument, put it a little differently, see if I do understand it. If somebody just thought about committing a crime and never did anything, it would not be a crime.
That's true.
And that's what it is from your perspective in conspiracy, because you have to have two people thinking about committing the crime.
At least.
At least. And then taking some kind, well, maybe not even taking a step other than maybe discussing it.
I believe we require an overt act.
Okay, some overt act. So you've got to get two people who are thinking about it and committing an overt act. If it's one person thinking about it and committing an overt act, it has to be a substantive crime, not conspiracy. That's your theory.
Yes.
In a nutshell.
Even though the one person thinks that the other person is also thinking about it.
If I may elaborate on that last question, under our current conspiracy statute, you still have to conspire to commit a substantive crime.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That was one of the changes.
Okay, now one of the, as I read the statute, you become guilty of the substantive offense that you're conspiring for.
Yes.
So here, the defendant was going to pick up drugs to deliver them. That was the conspiracy.
Supposedly, yes.
Supposedly. Therefore, that would be a felony?
Well, again, that would be a matter of prosecutorial discretion. It could be a felony. It could also have been charged as a misdemeanor, as a simple possession.
Yeah, but if it was conspiracy to possess with the intent to deliver, that was the charge.
Yes.
That's correct. Now, suppose that he was just going to pick up the drugs for his own use. He has a guy who's willing to sell, he's willing to buy, but he doesn't actually get possession.
Mm-hmm.
Just before this possession, he's picked up, he's arrested. So that would be a conspiracy to possess, with the intent to possess.
Right.
Because he's going to use it himself. That would be a misdemeanor or a felony, depending on the nature of the drugs and the amount, et cetera. So you look to see. So this was a receiver for resale. That would be a felony. If he was a receiver for use, it would be the crime of possession for use.
I'm
just trying to test out what we're talking about here.
Okay.
And if he actually had gotten the materials, the drugs, then you wouldn't have to charge conspiracy, right?
I believe that is correct. I noticed in reviewing for writing the briefs that had Mr. Sample succeeded in making the delivery to the confidential informant at the jail, he could not be charged under party to a crime conspiracy. It would no longer be a conspiracy if he succeeded. It's a conspiracy. That's why the unilateral, perhaps as a matter of, getting back to your point about common sense, as a matter of common sense, under the unilateral approach to inquiry conspiracy, if you fail, you're guilty of a conspiracy in this case. But on the other hand, if Mr. Sample had succeeded to get the controlled substances back to the job, or back to the jail, it would not be a conspiracy anymore.
Explain why.
Well, because under, and it's agreed by both parties, under party to a crime conspiracy, you do require two actors intending that a criminal objective be achieved.
Now, why did you slip into 93905? That's parties to a crime.
Well, a lot of our case law is interpreting the party to a crime statute, and also the fact that there's been some discussion regarding the language of the 939.31. Now, the party to a crime conspiracy has been defined consistently as also requiring bilateral interpretation. And noting for your honors that the first word in 939.05 is whoever, the same word that is the first word in 939.31.
And what's the difference between being a conspirator and being a party to a crime conspiracy?
The difference is that the 939.31 is the inchoate or incomplete crimes, such as solicitation and attempt and conspiracy, whereas the party...
That's 2C, right.
I'm sorry.
Person is concerned with the commission of crime, the person is a party to a conspiracy with another to commit it.
Yes, ma'am.
Can you be charged with 939.05-2C and 939.31?
I'm sorry, would you...
Can he be charged with both 939.31 and 939.2C?
You cannot, in my understanding, is you cannot, a person cannot be charged with both an incomplete crime and a completed crime under Wisconsin law. You cannot be charged with both in the same act.
Okay. What's the retroactive application of this court's determination that it's bilateral for all those defendants currently serving time involved in a situation like this?
To the best of my knowledge, there, with the exception of perhaps Mr. Sample, of course, I'm not aware of any other appellants who might be out there as far as retroactivity is concerned. I'm not familiar with any. There may indeed be some, but I'm not familiar with any. I think the main effect will be what will happen to people who have currently have charges pending against them. And I also would think it would be a matter of how the prosecutors are going to handle situations like this in the future. And by that, I mean not that they're going to tell the sheriff, you can't go out and do reverse stings anymore, or these sort of setups, and that's exactly what it was a setup. But their charging discretion would be that they'll charge you with some other crime. I don't think we've ever tried to say that Mr. Sample isn't guilty of doing something, just that he's not guilty of a conspiracy.
What's the relationship between entrapment and unilateral?
Unilateral conspiracy would open the door greatly for entrapment, because taking a situation like Mr. Sample's, getting away from some of the specifics in the history, they could have had an inmate such as Mr. Wheeler gone out and solicited a corrections officer to engage in this sort of activity, had an undercover officer, such as Ms. Bandow, also posed as a decoy. So potentially if some of the specific facts had been a bit different on this case and in other cases in the future, assuming that society goes as it is going, there is a real potential and a real danger for a new area of entrapment.
But those matters are really not related to each other, are they? I mean, the one case, the case that we have with your client, the purpose of the discussion, I think, I don't know if you'll admit to it or not, but his mindset was to commit a conspiracy, his intent was to commit a conspiracy. He thought the other person was going to commit the conspiracy, and the argument is that since that person didn't really intend it, there's no crime. Entrapment is a focus on whether or not your client would have committed the crime but for the encouragement, the enticing, or the coercion of the agent. And really, in that case, your client's mindset would be that I would never have committed a crime except that I was, you know, that I was somehow forced or coerced or cajoled into committing a crime that I didn't intend to commit. I mean, that's a different focus completely, isn't it? I mean, your argument is, well, when one person's an agent as opposed to another criminal, you may have police trying to encourage people to commit crimes, but other than that, there really is no connection between the two theories.
Well, yes, there actually is, because we must bear in mind that what we do here this afternoon will have an impact and an effect not only on pending cases, as I've been advised by some fellow defense attorneys, that they have cases where exactly the scenario that I described has occurred.
Well, this is a common phenomenon, is it not, for police agencies not only to use their own police officers, but in fact to use informants to go out and to interact with a defendant. They may not always be charged with conspiracy, but that's certainly not an unusual phenomenon that occurs in law enforcement today.
Oh, no, it is by no means an unusual phenomenon. It is an unusual phenomenon, however, to charge it as a conspiracy. But I've been advised by some of my, as I say, by some of my fellow defense attorneys that is now, they now have cases with those types of scenarios are occurring now. And I suspect one of the reasons that the prosecutors are favoring charging as conspiracy is because they gain some undue advantages there, as I believe LaFave and Scott point out, the admissibility of hearsay evidence, the fact that they can prove the existence of conspiracy by circumstantial evidence, and the negative impact of the word, just the word conspiracy, I think, above all that. If one pictures in their mind a conspiracy, I think one conjures up images of very sinister individuals hiding in the shadows in long trench coats. So I would say that, yeah, you do run into new danger of a new form of entrapment.
But none of the things you just listed involve entrapment. It may be other things. It may be evidence.
Well, no, it is other things, but other things in addition to entrapment. You're right. I would say, yes, the prosecutors do have an undue advantage when they charge a conspiracy, and I would say the unilateral would give them even more of an advantage as opposed to the bilateral. But again, reminding the court that even under the bilateral interpretation, the person could still be charged with another crime. We did discuss somewhat what the changes were with regards to the law in 1953. The Legislative Council, in their commentary in the 1953 Council, which was the Judiciary Council, stated that they were making four changes in enacting this new statute. First change was an intent to do a lawful act by unlawful means was abolished. Secondly, knowledge of the criminality of an act was no longer required. Third, crimes that require two essential parties can be prosecuted as a conspiracy. I believe that was the abolition of the so-called Wharton rule, if I remember correctly. And fourth, an overt act was added as an element to the offense, which was not present in the old statute. When the legislative council was making reference services, the court referred to the case of O'Neill versus State, and also, as I say, to the Arizona statute as an analogous statute to Wisconsin's new one. And Arizona's statute did clearly require two persons with criminal intent.
Did Wisconsin borrow that language from the Arizona statute, clearly requiring two persons with intent?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Did Wisconsin borrow Arizona's statute verbatim?
I apologize.
Sure. Did Wisconsin adopt Arizona's statute verbatim?
No, it did not. But I would note that when they do list the string citation of analogous legislation in both 1950 and 1953, they listed the Arizona statute first in both versions. And Arizona's statute, as I said earlier, was not reformed until 1978, in which the legislature specifically adopted a unilateral approach. Further questions? I'll save my time for rebuttal.
You have time anyway, but if you are finished, that's fine. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Balestrieri, Assistant Attorney General representing the state. Mr. Balestrieri.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to
start out by pointing out that there, if you read these comments, the 1950 comments and the 1953 comments, there's nothing anywhere in any of those comments that suggests that people who crafted Wisconsin's statute were modeling it after the statutes of any other state, Louisiana, Arizona, anybody else. It's pretty clear, rather, that if you read the comments as a whole, what they were doing is crafting an entirely new statute, taking little bits from one statute, a little bit from another statute, a little bit from here, a little bit from there. But they were putting together something completely new, something completely different. They didn't just take the Louisiana statute and change a few words. They didn't just take the Arizona statute, change a few words. They created something entirely new. They put in language that, as far as I'm aware, had never appeared in anybody else's statute before. It's appeared in a lot of statutes since. It appears in the Model Penal Code since. But as far as I'm aware, the language never appeared in any other statute before, and that's the critical language that we're talking about. Whoever with intent to commit a crime agrees or conspires, that's new. That's a first time, as far as I'm aware, in the history of jurisprudence that kind of language ever appeared in a statute. It's not in a Louisiana statute that was in existence at that time, not in the Arizona statute was in existence at that time, not in a federal statute that's still in existence, not in any other statute. These guys, and I'm talking about people like Bill Platts, Assistant Attorney General Bill Platts, I'm talking about Professor Frank Remington, some of the real giants in the history of criminal law in this state, put together something that was completely unique. And they intended to put together something that was completely unique. They said that that's what they're doing. They said, this represents a complete change from the old law, represents a complete change from common law conspiracy, the kind of conspiracy that incorporated a bilateral theory requiring the actual agreement of two or more persons. And they took that language out. Language that said you need an agreement between two or more persons, and they said whoever agrees, whoever conspires, whoever is a word that can, it's an indefinite pronoun, can be either singular or plural. If one person agrees, if more than one person agrees, you have a crime. The verb forms are singular, agrees, conspires, again indicating if one person does it, that's enough. And that kind of language, which has been incorporated in other statutes, including the Model Penal Code, since the time that the Wisconsin statute was adopted, has almost uniformly been construed to incorporate the unilateral theory of conspiracy. In fact, the Model Penal Code, which is the paradigm unilateral statute, has almost exactly that language in it. The Wisconsin statute, though, goes even farther than some of the statutes of the other states. It not only says whoever agrees or conspires is guilty of a conspiracy. It says whoever with intent that a crime be committed is guilty of a conspiracy. And that phrase, whoever with intent that a crime be committed, applies only to the original whoever in that statute, the singular person. There is nothing in this statute which suggests on its face that the person who constitutes the conspirator, the person with whom there is agreement, must have an intent to commit a crime. It's only the individual defendant who must have the intent to commit a crime. And that is as plain, I think, as anything could possibly be on its face, that this statute only requires that one person have a criminal intent. And because the statute is pretty clear on its face, it is really unnecessary and really not permissible to go beyond the face of the statute to determine legislative intent. But if the court should do that, and if the court should go to the 1950 and 1953 comments,
I think the court has to remember one thing. This is a pioneering effort. And whenever you have pioneering efforts, the commentary is not always absolutely clear. Sometimes you're going to get a little ambiguity because it is a pioneering effort. This is a break from the past, and breaks from the past are not always as absolutely clear as they might be. And then there is some ambiguity in the comments. But if you look at them as a whole, I think it is pretty clear that what the people who drafted this statute intended was to create a very new kind of statute, a unilateral kind of statute. To begin with, they said that that's what they were doing. They said they were creating a whole new kind of statute, a complete break from the past, a complete break from the common law bilateral theory. And we have no reason not to take them at their word. We have no reason to think they didn't intend to do exactly what they said they were intending to do. If you look at the theory behind the new kind of conspiracy, there's a suggestion in there that they intended to incorporate a whole new theory of law. The old theory was that you needed an agreement between two people, because when you had two people conspiring, two people actually agreeing together, there was an increased danger. These comments say that's the old theory. That's the old view. It's not the view that's taken in creating this statute. Under this statute, we want to punish a person, a single person, who intends to commit a crime before that person commits it. That's a complete break with the past. It's a complete break with the theory underlying bilateral conspiracy. In addition, the focus is different. The focus is not on the act, which in the case of conspiracy is the agreement. That's not the focus anymore. That was the old focus. That's the old focus of common law bilateral conspiracy. Here, the focus is plainly on the intent of the defendant. The agreement, the act, is relevant only insofar as it shows that the defendant has that intent. To effectuate this new focus, the comments plainly say that what we look at here is not the facts as they actually are, but in determining criminal liability, we specifically look at the facts as the actor thinks they are. We look at his subjective viewpoint. And if he thinks he's agreeing with someone to commit a crime, then, in fact, he is agreeing with someone to commit a crime for purposes of this statute. Now, there are, as I said, some ambiguous comments. There are some comments which suggest that we still want to look at the question of whether there's a common scheme, some working together, common purpose. And there is some citation to old Wisconsin cases, old bilateral Wisconsin cases, which do have that language. But these comments have to be put in the perspective of what I've just been talking about. The fact that the agreement is not a critical element of the crime anymore. Intent is the critical element.
Let me interrupt you for a minute. How do you answer the argument that's been made, it's made in the briefs, that there's a policy underlying conspiracy statutes, and that policy is one that's aimed at preventing group activity crime, in other words, more than one person being involved in a crime? If that's indeed the policy behind conspiracy statutes, how do you then justify a unilateral approach?
I answer that by the drafters of this statute answered it, by saying that, yes, that is indeed the policy behind the bilateral theory of conspiracy. No question about it. But that's not the policy behind our new conspiracy statute. They make very plain, over and over again in the comments, that they are not creating this new crime of conspiracy for the purpose or with the policy of punishing two people who conspire to commit a crime. They state over and over again, as clear as a bell, that what they're intending to do now is something new, something different from punishing two people. They want to punish one person because they now have concluded that one person who wants to commit a crime and who engages in this act of conspiring with another person to commit a crime is every bit as dangerous as two people conspiring to commit a crime. That's the policy, that's the new policy, the change in policy behind the present statute.
Is that the policy behind the model penal code?
That is the policy behind the model penal code, exactly. And I might add, not only behind that, but behind all of the other statutes that have been adopted, adopting the language of the model penal code. It's a totally different philosophy. A totally different philosophy from the philosophy which underlies the old bilateral theory. And clearly under the comments, clearly under the language of the statute, the drafters of the Wisconsin inchoate conspiracy statute intended to effectuate the new policy and to reject the old one. I would just like to make one very brief comment on the case law. All of which traces its origin, or almost all of which traces its origin to the Nutley case, which was a party to the crime case. And party to crime liability is very different from inchoate conspiracy liability. Because when you're talking about a party to a crime, you're talking about vicarious liability for a substantive crime which has actually been committed by someone other than the person who's charged as a conspiracy. So you need two people to commit a crime as a party to the crime. And both of those people have to intend to commit the crime, or there's no crime.
Well, wait. You're telling me that under
9905, 2A, 2C,
you've got to have, it's bilateral?
Yes, that's bilateral. You have to have a substantive crime committed.
Well, and you've got to have the other guy, that's in a conspiracy intended to be a crime?
Sure. Otherwise, there's no crime.
So that in this case, for example, if the two of them made an agreement about delivering a drug, and it was the defendant who made the delivery and completed the crime, you could charge the defendant under 2C. You couldn't charge the defendant under 2C because the other guy did not intend a crime. Suppose this had all been completed.
Yeah.
And the other person here, who was a police officer, really never got into the ultimate act. You have to change the facts so that they didn't get the drugs or anything. But you couldn't charge conspiracy because the other person here was a police officer. Didn't intend to ultimate crime.
Well, under your altered fact situation, what we'd be charging this guy with is simply the substantive crime.
That's right.
That is the direct committer.
And you could not charge him with a conspiracy.
I don't know why you'd want to.
Well, because from what I've seen on the charges, they charge him with everything. They charge him as a direct participant. They charge him under aiding and abetting, and they charge him as a conspiracy, and they don't even have to, the jury doesn't have to unanimously agree.
Well, they
charge him with everything.
Yeah, my experience, they only do that when there's a question about what his involvement is.
Okay, so let's say there's a question, but your answer to me would be that you couldn't charge him with conspiracy because it's not bilateral. I mean, that's what I heard you say. That's why.
Well, I think it's probably true. I mean, I don't see how you could charge him with conspiring with someone who didn't intend.
I just read in the instructions, maybe in the Legislative Council report, that 93931 and 93905 2C are exactly the same.
Well, they're not exactly the same. That's not true.
I know that one
they're,
is.
They're quite different, in fact.
I know one is a completed one, but the concept of conspiracy is the same. I'll fight it.
Well,
decide whether or not.
Depends on what, how broadly you want to define the concept of conspiracy. There are, in fact, many similarities between inchoate conspiracy and conspiracy as a party to the crime. But there are some significant differences, too.
Here it is. It's in the comment on jury instruction 570. Comment 2, the definition of conspiracy is the same as the one used for the instructions on conspiracy alternative of party to crime liability.
Oh, you're reading from the comments to the jury instructions. No, they're absolutely wrong.
You're wrong.
They're flatly wrong.
It's your position that they're wrong because under 05 it's bilateral and under 31 it's unilateral.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's correct to say that 939-05 is bilateral. I don't think the bilateral or unilateral theory even comes into play when you're talking about 939-05 because you're not talking about an inchoate conspiracy. You're talking about a completed substantive crime and the liability of someone who is not the direct committer of that crime as a conspiracy. So I don't even think it's appropriate to talk in terms of bilateral and unilateral when you're discussing 939-05. I think bilateral and unilateral are concepts that apply to an inchoate crime, an inchoate conspiracy, something that exists prior to the commission of a completed crime. You're talking about 939-05. You're talking about a completed substantive crime.
Well, you'd always have a bilateral situation because you always have to think to one person who actually committed the crime.
Yeah, I mean,
committed the crime,
yeah.
Right? And one person who didn't wasn't directly involved with charges.
Yeah, you always have to have a bilateral fact situation. So because you always have to have a bilateral fact situation, I don't think it's appropriate to talk in terms of bilateral or unilateral theories under that statute. You need two people. That's it.
I thought you needed two people under 31 also.
Yeah, you need
two people.
You need two people.
You don't have a conspiracy.
Yeah, but you don't need the agreement of two people under 9. Under the inchoate conspiracy statute.
You don't need an agreement of two people that they both commit the crime.
Right.
To be precise.
Yeah. You don't need an actual agreement. What you need is simply the appearance of an agreement. I would just like to finally just address this question of entrapment. I don't think this court should even be considering questions of entrapment. I don't think this court should be considering questions of policy. This court is not writing on a clean slate here. This case involves statutory construction. And the question is not what this court would or would not do as a matter of policy. The question is, what did the legislature do as a matter of policy? What was the policy that they picked? What was the policy that they chose? People have been debating for years, for decades, whether it is better to take a bilateral approach or a unilateral approach. There are lots of law review articles written on the subject. They're still being written. There's a lot of debate. You read some of the federal cases and under the federal bilateral statute, and they say, oh, this unilateral statute, it's terrible stuff. Oh, we're so glad we have a bilateral statute because, gosh, look at all the abuses. And then you read other cases and say, oh, we're so glad we have a unilateral statute because this bilateral business is crazy. It doesn't make any difference to the liability of one defendant what the state of mind of the other defendant is. So you've got a conflict, and you've got two different views, both of which are supported. You can support them rationally on grounds of policy. And I want to ask this court not to do what the Washington Supreme Court did. If there is ever an example of what a court should not do in terms of statutory construction, it's what the Washington Supreme Court did in the Pacheco case. That is the worst statutory construction case I have ever read. It's not statutory construction, it was statutory reconstruction. They totally rewrote a statute because they obviously didn't like it.
How would you have written this to be absolutely clear without question? Your answer it already is, but you can improve it, otherwise we wouldn't have had two cases of these come up. How would you write this to be sure that it was unilateral?
I think it's clear on its face that it is unilateral. I mean, I don't think there's a problem with it. I think it's clear. I don't think it needs to be rewritten, but if you want to make it even more clear, I think what the legislature could have done is added the kind of language that they wrote in the comments and taking it from the comments and put it into the language of the statute itself, making it very clear that the focus was on the intent of the actor and that the facts had to be viewed from the subjective viewpoint of the actor and liability predicated on what the actor believed. I mean, I guess that's what I would have done. I think the legislature, or at least the drafting committee, plainly wrote out everything that they needed to write to make clear that this was a unilateral statute. They just put it in two pages of comments instead of the language of the statute itself. If there are no other questions, I will conclude my argument. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Balistrieri. Counsel, you have time for rebuttal, Mr. Sealing.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, I guess Mr. Balistrieri and myself disagree on what is in that commentary on the Legislative Reference Council. In preparing my outline for today, and if you honors wouldn't give me just a second, because I did write down some of the quotes from this. In the commentary, the Legislative Council stated that the act of conspiracy is either an agreement or a combination for a purpose of committing a crime. Those are their words. That's the legislature speaking. And further, they said the co-conspirators, and I note for you the use of the plural word, co-conspirators, must have some common scheme, some working together for a common purpose. That, Your Honors, I would submit to you is a reference, a specific reference to the commentary that indicates that the legislature did not intend to adopt any sort of unilateral approach. I would suggest to Your Honors further that had the legislature intended to do so, they probably would have come out and said so. But they didn't. They specified four changes from common law conspiracy, and the unilateral approach was not among them. I would also take issue with whether or not other states that have adopted conspiracy laws since Wisconsin and laws that are somewhat worded towards the Model Penal Code have interpreted them uniformly under unilateral approach. Specifically, I found six states, Colorado, Connecticut, Florida, Illinois, Pennsylvania, and Washington, which adopted statutes, and I believe most of those states were adopted their new conspiracy statutes after the Model Penal Code and did not adopt the unilateral approach. As a matter of fact, in Illinois, in the case of People versus Foster, the Illinois statute states a person is guilty of conspiracy. That's as their current statute reads. But the Foster court said, despite what the Model Penal Code said, they were going to interpret the intent of their legislature as being one of bilateral. I do not find any references to unilateral approach within the commentary of the Legislative Council. And I would also note, as I did in my briefs, that the Model Penal Code was adopted nearly a decade after Wisconsin. It is difficult. Perhaps the revisers of the statute did have something like that in mind, but again, I would say we have to go by what they stated, not only what they stated in their own words, but also the authoritative reference sources they referred to at the end of their commentary. And I would note, to the best of my knowledge, none of those authoritative reference sources refer to a unilateral approach or to adopting it. I believe with the matter of the word whoever, there was a change that I understand in modern conspiracy law. It used to be under old conspiracy law, in order to have a conviction for conspiracy, everyone who was involved had to be convicted of the conspiracy. If one person was acquitted, then none of them could be convicted of a conspiracy. And I believe that changed through court decision of the U.S. Supreme Court during the century, where that rule was abolished, where one person can be convicted of conspiracy but not the other. Taking to the current scenario, suppose Mr. Wheeler, instead of being the confidential informant
essentially trading Mr. Sample for favorable treatment, was instead a willing participant and intended the crime to be committed. Now, assuming further that changing scenario that this whole thing fell apart and there was arrest, et cetera, he could have essentially turned state's evidence, not been charged with conspiracy, not can be convicted, but a fellow actor could, still nonetheless. And that is a change from the common law conspiracy, although it is not referenced specifically in the commentary. I would submit to your honors that I, as I said earlier, I believe on a couple of occasions, I do not see where the Legislative Council made any references to a unilateral approach at all. And I would ask your honors to consider that as evidence of the legislative intent of our conspiracy law and consider it thusly. Thank you.
Thank you, Celia. The court is in recess until November 19th.